Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, hey, welcome to Page Break. I'm your host, Brian McClellan, coming to you on a blustery day in the mountains of Utah. Today's guest is science fiction author Wesley Chu. Wes is the author of The Lives of Tau and Time Salvager. In addition to his own work, he's written tie-in fiction for both The Walking Dead and Cassandra Clare's Mortal Instruments. Wes and I have been friends since our debut novels came out in the same month back in 2013, and we dive right in to talk about our respective careers and lurking professional anxieties. We also cover tie-in writing, intellectual property, and the holy grail of novel writing, the coveted TV and film deals. It was a blast catching up, and I hope you enjoy my chat with Wes.
An idea that's been sitting in the back of my head since like 2015. I've always wanted to write this Asian epic fantasy, you know, this kung fu fantasy series, and I remember like I wanted to write it for a long time, and around like 2018, you know, like a lot of my peers are writing like really like I feel like really important books about the moment, books about our culture, books about the future, futurism, society, and everything. And when people ask me like, "Oh, Wes, what are you gonna work on next?" I was like, "I want to write a kung fu fantasy," you know. But you know what? It all worked out for me. But definitely, I sold the book off a partial in the end of 2019, and I spent the bulk of 2020 writing this, you know, this epic fantasy. It was 180,000 words. Yeah. It's a good size, but it wasn't like, but I felt like.
A lot longer than what you normally do, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my biggest book before that was 165, and that was an outlier. Everything else is like 110 to 125, whatever. Yeah. And I just remember, like, after I finished, like, I was working really hard till I finished, and right when I finished, I just fell off the cliff.
Yeah.
Like, I blew my wad getting this book out, and then I just could not do anything for 6 months.
I mean, I've definitely felt like that before. I mean, like the book that I'm working on right now, you know, so Glass Immortals, the first book that's coming out next June. I turned in the first draft, and my first drafts are normally pretty clean. And I turned in the first draft, and I just kind of had a bad feeling about it when I turned it in.
Okay,
and that was last October, I think. In 2020, and I had spent all of 2020 just like crazy working on it, no side projects, nothing else going on, just this book. And I turned it in, didn't feel good about it, and then, you know, my editor came back, gosh, you know, like 3 weeks later, and said, "You know, this isn't your best work, right?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I know." But you know, thankfully she said, "Look, go back. You know what to fix. Go back, work on it." And I've done, I think, 3 pretty extensive drafts for it.
Wow.
And it's only until this last one, you know, let's see, first draft was October, and then third big draft was beginning of May. So it was only until I really turned in that third one that I felt really good about it.
How big's the book?
215.
Oh my gosh.
The first draft was 235, I think.
I mean, here's the one thing that I've always said about, you know, really becoming a more veteran in this field is that no matter what book I'm working on,
yeah,
every book I'm working on is the hardest book I've ever written. I'm you know, but it's not just that. Is I never feel like I'm getting more comfortable.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm getting better at writing. I don't feel like, you know, I don't feel like I'm leveling up.
Yeah.
But what I do know that I do get better at is I know when something is wrong.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I don't feel like something's better. But I know when something I'm working on just doesn't feel right. And that's kind of like the leveling up part.
I listened a couple years ago to a podcast with Philip Pullman, and he talked about how becoming a more experienced author doesn't make things easier, because what happens is that you suddenly you're able to see like the branching possibilities
right.
of every single decision that your characters make. And so when you level up as an author, it actually becomes harder because you can now see this infinite universe. And so you've got choice paralysis of where do I go with each right. little thing.
And it's also like, before I went pro, before I sold my first book, I was so confident in everything I did.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm writing, I'm like, this is the greatest plot line. This is the greatest dialogue. Everything's wonderful. And it's just, it's almost like a confidence from ignorance, you know? And now that I've done like, you know, whatever, you know, 10, 11 books, every decision I make, I'm like, is this what it should be? And then I question everything so much more now because, you know, maybe it's because I do see all those infinite paths and it really takes a long time to kind of like narrow down to, is what's happening right now the best possible choice for the story? And does it serve, you know, the characters best?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I run into the exact same thing. And it's very frustrating.
Can I ask you this question? Let me ask you this question. I'm going to ask you this question.
Oh, yeah, okay. Go ahead.
So, I mean, you started out, you know, you came out of, You came into publishing like right out of the canon. You know, you have a huge epic fantasy. It's done really well for you. It's got longevity. It's a long tail in the market. Have you found that the more successful you've become, the harder it is to write?
I don't know. I think that there's like a part of me that really wants to like rest on my laurels, kind of thing.
Right.
And want to say, oh, yeah, you know, I can put out an epic fantasy every 2 years. It's no big deal. I don't have to have side projects. I don't have to push myself too hard. You know, there's a part of me that does that. But for the writing itself, I don't think it has much to do with my success rather versus what we just talked about in terms of,
right.
you know, my abilities as a writer and my kind of knowledge of what's doing things right and wrong is a lot better. And so it makes it harder to really finish something and feel satisfied with
right.
it. But I don't think with success, I don't think that bothers me too much. Because, you know, I'm always going to have bills to pay. And even if I pay all my bills, I'm going to want crap, you know? There's crap. Always going to be something like, oh, I want to put in a pool. I better write a new book, you know? So it's just, I don't know. What about you?
Well, I mean, you and I came out from opposite corners of the field.
Yeah, but like the same month, right?
It was like a summer or spring, like 2013 release, right?
Yeah. Yeah, mine was April 2013.
No, mine was April 2013, right? But yours came from a big five publishing house, from Orbit Books, and it was a
yeah.
And you had Pierce Brosnan on. Was it Pierce Brosnan on your cover?
Mm-hmm. It was his stunt double is on my cover.
Yeah, and like so you came out, you know, with a very healthy advance, and you had Pierce Brosnan's stunt double as your cover guy, and coming from Orbit Books, you know, coming from Hachette. And I came up through a small press, Angry Robot,
yeah.
mass market. It sold a lot of copies, but it was like, you know, it was a smaller market than yours.
Right.
And I feel like for the first like maybe 6-7 books, I really operated from a place of like, I haven't made it yet, place of like desperation almost, because like, you know, when I went full time writing in 2014, my wife was like, all right, I'm gonna give you 2 years. You need to get a job. so for 2014, 2015, I'm like, I better work my ass off, because if I don't, I might need to go back to the office one of these days. And that was like a terrifying source of motivation for me. And now that I've quote unquote made it, I'm more established. I know that, you know, my dad isn't trying to get me job interviews anymore at the local bank or whatever he's trying to do. now that I hit a good plateau, and I know I signed my next book, my last book deal is going to keep me busy for the next 3-4 years or 2-3 years, whatever. I don't know. I feel like I lost a little bit of that edge. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Like, on one hand, I shouldn't be operating from that source. It's not a great place to operate from. But on the other hand, it really kept me going for a long time.
Right. I don't know. I guess for me, it's always been... I don't have that kind of external pressure because I didn't come from an established career.
Right.
I was just a few years out of college and I had just worked crap jobs and been unemployed for a big period of time. And so I hadn't really had anything that I was coming from to compare it to. You know, anything that made me more than the equivalent of $9 an hour was a step up for me. And so I guess my I guess the little bit of an edge I have on that is that I don't want to go back to making $9 an hour.
Yes.
And so I definitely have that thing of, you know, I need to put out good books and I need them to do well.
Right.
And I need to keep up my momentum. But I don't have kind of the external family pressure and the financial pressure of,
right,
of comparing it to other things like you do.
Well, I mean, the truth of the matter is, I mean, at least for me, I'm pretty sure for both of us, but I definitely for me, I'm pretty sure that we're both unemployable from this point on outside of writing books.
I don't know. I feel like you have at least, you've got something that you could go back to if you really needed to. But maybe I'm wrong. I mean, industries change quickly.
I mean, the IT industry changes like literally every 6 months.
Because you came from banking.
I mean, I came from the tech side of
banking. Okay.
And tech moves super quick. So like,
yeah.
I remember this. When I went full time, I remember like 6 months after I went full time, I was like, I don't remember how to log into any of my Unix systems that I used to do. I mean, literally my brain capacity is finite. So everything that had to do with my previous career was literally just like shelled out the window to bring in more writing stuff.
Yeah.
And now I don't remember anything. I can't even log into it, like any system now for the life of me. So unemployable.
I guess I think about it once in a while. I do think about that. And I guess the options are pretty slim. You know, it's maybe I could get into technical writing. Maybe I could do IP work, which you've done some IP work recently. You know, there's a couple of options, but yeah, like I couldn't go get a real 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's kind of like we're all in on this.
So how's life been doing? Have you been, you're a kind of a stay-at-home dad in addition to writing, right?
I mean, I think everybody who has kids over the past year, everybody's been basically a stay-at-home parent.
Yeah.
No, it's weird because when the pandemic first, you know, when the quarantine first started, you know, I thought to myself, this is no big deal because I've been working at home since 2013. And with the way my wife and I had everything set up, I still get, you know, most of my writing time. Not that much should have changed, but it actually did change because before I used to have the whole house to myself. And now like my kids were home.
Yeah.
My wife is home. And something about just other people being in the house with me just like drove me crazy, you know?
Right.
And that's not even like trying to work while holding the kid at bay. You know, I have a 2 and a 5-year-old right now. And so I had a 1 and a 4-year-old when the quarantine happened, and it was, you know, it was rough.
Yeah.
It just like an extra layer of stress that just kind of hovered over you.
Right. Right. Cause you know, spouses are suddenly working at home and the kids don't have daycare suddenly, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
That changes. You know, I felt the same way as you did, where I just went into the pandemic kind of thinking, oh, nothing's really going to change, you know, cause I don't even have children. but yeah. And it kind of claws at you.
Yeah.
And you know, being kind of stuck in your house without being able to really go out and socialize, without being able to say, man, I want to go visit a friend or something. I'm going to hop on a plane and go somewhere. You know, it limits your options for the ways that you can kind of
decompress,
get your brain to
de-stress, you know,
yeah,
take a break from whatever you're thinking about. I'm not going to lie. I actually don't have that many friends. I didn't have that many friends to visit, let's be honest. But one thing that really I did realize is, you know, I used to go out to a lot of conventions. That's where we all should hang out. And that was definitely like one great outlet for me to, you know, decompress, you know, hang out with people who, you know, with other authors who kind of like, who know what you're going through, what you're working on, and kind of, you know, your community.
Yeah.
And once I lost that, that's when the buildup started happening. You know, that's when the burnout started coming out. Even though my day to day didn't feel that much different, but it was just that additional small layer of stress that building on each other.
Yeah. So you mentioned the kids. Like, do you find it kind of a distraction, just having children in general? This is something I don't have experience with at all. Do you find it a distraction from the other things you want to do in life, or do you find it as a something that kind of keeps you alive and keeps you going?
I mean, the honest answer is it's definitely both.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at my productivity, I think I have 11 books published, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And from 2013 to 2016, I was publishing 2 books a year.
Right.
And then 2016 to 2016 to now, I've published 3 books.
Yeah.
Okay. And part of it's because I've been leveling up. You know, I've been working on bigger titles. I've done some tie-in from 2016 to 2019. But it's having kids takes up so much brain space, you know? And it's not just like, okay, I can't work because I have to take care of my kids from 1 to 5 today.
Right.
It's like, you take care of your kids from 1 to 5, but then you think about all the things that comes along with parenthood, where are they going to go to preschool? How are you feeding them? How do you potty train them? You know? So every day right now from 5 till 9 is kid time.
Yeah.
Where I'm hanging out with my kids, I'm feeding them. They're running around like crazy. They're doing what little boys do. And then they go to bed, which is great because that's the best time of the year is right after the kids go to bed. That's something I see all the time. But then, here's what it is after the kids, after you're done with the kids, you can't just sit down and start working again.
Yeah.
You know, I sit down and I stare at the wall for 20 minutes just because your brain needs to kind of come down from that. And for me as a writer, my best writing time is from 9 to 12.
Yeah.
But then after you're dealing with kids all day, my brain isn't just wired for that anymore. So it takes a long time now for me to get situated into a headspace of, okay, now let's get some words down.
Yeah.
And that's the real drag of having kids is it's not just when you're with them. They're also on your mind when you're not with them. So.
Right. Well, it's going to be that way with any responsibility.
That is true. But children are a different beast. They really are,
Right.
It's hard to explain unless you really have to deal with it. And it's something that we all have to learn to handle. I mean, I know some authors, I remember talking to John Scalzi once and he was saying how when he had Athena, who's 16 now, 16, 17 now, but when he didn't really have that much help, outside of their family. But what he did was he was very good about when the baby goes down for her 2-hour nap, mm-hmm. she starts working. He's very good about that transition. And that's actually a skill you have to develop, which I never developed. Because when my babies go down, I just want to stare at the wall or drink some scotch for an hour. And it takes me so long to transition over to that right headspace. And that's something that for the next 10, 15 years, I got to figure out.
Have you always had trouble transitioning into kind of the writer brain? Before kids, was it easier?
I would say that I probably still had some transition that I had to go through every time, but I transitioned playing video games.
Yeah.
So I would sit down and before I started working on something, I would play a game of Dota or something, or play a couple turns of Civilization.
Right.
And then after maybe 15, 20, half an hour, maybe an hour sometimes, but then I get into it, and then I could write. But back then though, we had so much more time on our hands. Whenever we got up, 8, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, whatever, we had no kids, wife's at work.
Yeah.
We spent all day puttering around, getting our work done. And we could typically, the spouse comes home, we hang out with them, whatever. And then we can work till 2 a.m. And it was perfectly fine. We had 18 hours mm-hmm. that we could allocate our brain space to. But then once you have kids, you are always on their schedule, So right now, both my kids go to preschool. So no matter mm-hmm. what, no matter how much sleep they get, no matter what they were doing the day before, they're going to wake up at the exact same time. So you don't get any extra sleep if you tire them out the night before. They wake up and then you're dealing with them for get in the car, get them breakfast, get them dressed, get them to school. You come back and it's probably 9:30, sometimes 10. And then I got to veg for half an hour. So by the time I actually start working, it's 10:30, 11 o'clock.
Right.
But then at 4 o'clock, I got to go pick them up. So suddenly the day that we used to have before we had kids, which would have been 8 to 10 hours, is 5. So
right.
That's a thing.
Kind of narrows your creative window.
And then at night when they go to bed, you have them from 5 to 8, 5 to 9. So now, and then after you put them down, you need to do that veg thing you do, which really I need to figure out just how to skip that entirely. Isn't that then you suddenly only have 10 to 1, but then you're also tired because you've been hanging out with kids all day. So our windows are drastically shorter than they used to be.
I'm always amazed at people who are able to not have that veg time. Cause I do struggle with transitions between, even if I'm working out in the yard or something, and then I want to come in and do a little bit of work, you know, it might take me an hour to kind of transition from doing a different thing,
right,
to doing a creative thing. And I know lots of people who will say, oh yeah, you know, I get up early in the morning and I take care of this and I squeeze in a little bit of writing for 20 minutes at this exact time because that's when the kids are doing this. And I'm always amazed at that kind of thing.
I mean, I was talking to Dana Gabaldon about this once. We were talking over email. And I mean, basically like Dana and like Stephen King, I think it was that in his book. It was like, he will work from what? Every day, his work is scheduled from 6 a.m. to like something like 10 a.m. or 11 a.m. or something like that. And that's their entire work day.
Yeah.
And then from that the rest of the day, they do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of these people, these authors, they train their brain to turn on into that writing mode at a certain time, and then they turn it off. So because they can definitively turn it on and off at certain times, during that time frame, they're so much more efficient. For us, I feel like you and I, we kind of have like this,
yeah,
work when we can, work when we feel like it, work when we have to. So our brain just needs a transition time, as opposed to when they have like set time periods every day to work on that. And that's probably the right way to do it. I just hate the idea of getting up at 6 a.m. to write. That just feels terrible.
Right. I mean, part of the reason I wanted to become a writer is so that I didn't have to keep a schedule. And so that giving into that, even though I know it would be a lot healthier for me on kind of an emotional and a mental basis.
Right.
I don't want to give in to that having a schedule thing.
Right.
You know, working from, you know, even if it was just, you know, 10 to 4 or something every weekday, I don't want to give into that.
Right. Definitely. I mean, yeah, but I mean, I wish I could make my work period like 9 to 2 every day. And then like during the daytime, I could just not worry about work.
Yeah.
If I could do that, I think, you know, I would have a more productive day. I could work out. I could take care of stuff around the house. But the idea, but I'm not doing that right now. And because I'm not doing that right now, on one hand, I'm always thinking about work in the back of my head. And I think instead of thinking about my work and my family and, you know, what to do, chores around the house, it makes me less efficient doing in all three aspects.
Yeah.
So one of these days, or it's like go to a writing retreat. Have you ever been to a writing retreat?
Only a couple times.
And the best part about it is you have nothing to think about but writing.
Yeah.
And so you can, in most cases, when you focus on just writing, you're writing more efficiently. You're doing better use of your time. You're not bouncing out of it as easily. Especially if you have other people who you're working on, you know, you're writing with. There's some accountability there.
Right. And that's kind of the cool thing about a writing retreat is that you're going to be with other writers. And so when you're not writing, you're probably talking about writing with them. And that can be kind of invigorating.
Right. Or just, I don't know. I mean, I'm my entire self is based off of like shame. I'm very shame motivated. So like when I'm writing with somebody and they're writing and I'm not, I just feel very guilty about it. And that's what motivates me to work.
Yeah. I don't believe in shame. maybe it's because I'm the youngest child. And so I could get away with a lot more than my like siblings did. But yeah, shame's, I've seen shame do a lot more damage than it's done.
That's fair.
You know, positive in general.
I mean, I don't want to, for me, it's almost a cultural thing.
Yeah.
Which is kind of stereotypical, I guess. But I am a fom. You know, I kind of grew up in the old country. So I carry a lot of that stuff with me. But.
Oh, man. I actually wanted to ask you about that. Because so you were born in Taiwan, right?
Right.
And so you lived there until you were about 6, I think?
I was 5. Came when I was 5. My grandparents raised me.
Do you remember that? Because you moved to Nebraska.
Yes.
And do you remember any amount of culture shock, or were you too young?
Yeah. I remember a decent amount of it. The thing is, when you're 5 years old, you're still adaptable to everything.
Yeah.
So like I remember going to kindergarten and like I couldn't speak a word of English. The only word I knew was no. But because I was 5, I mean, I think I learned English in like 3 weeks. It was just, you know, just you can learn, pick it up so quickly. And I don't think culture shock. I don't think I actually had any culture shock, just because I kind of like, okay, I'm here and there's other kids and I don't know what they're saying, but we all can kick a ball. So let's figure this out. And eventually once I learned how to, I mean, if I came in and I was like 8, I think that would have been a problem. I would have had something in a culture shock.
Yeah.
But because it came so early, it wasn't a big deal for me.
Yeah. Do you think you transitioned really well then?
Yeah. Let me think. Did I have any problems? One thing about, you know, so I went to kindergarten in Taiwan.
Yeah.
So I just started the school system. And one thing about the school systems, at least back then, was they were a lot more strict than they are in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came out here, all I had to do was follow directions, which is really easy, you know, if you're used to that environment. So I think if it was the other way around, where you kind of have a more, you know, I don't want to say free society, but like just less strict of an environment, you would have more of a problem adapting. But because I came from the other way around, it wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
I also read a lot of books.
Yeah.
Like my dad, one of the first things my dad did was, you know, he took me to, like, you know, a bookstore, and he wanted and just said, you know, pick some books, learn English, which is what. And I, you know, and I started off the Zanth books. Piers Anthony was how I learned to speak English.
Really, at that age, that young?
I might have been like 6 or 7 by the time we actually did that. But
right, but that's still very young for Piers Anthony.
I didn't understand a lot of the nuances. I'm not gonna lie. I was like, I didn't even realize there was kind of like, you know, some goofy things about some of the underlining themes until I got to The Color of Her Panties.
Right,
which was like book 16 or something like that. And I was like, what are panties? And it took me a while. It took me a while to kind of like build up to that. But for the,
but
as a young kid, around 7 to 9, whatever, it was like a magical thing for me. You know, once you keep the innocence of those stories, they're super entertaining. It's not until you get like kind of pseudo puberty that you're like, something's a little off here.
Yeah, I think I read a few of the Piers Anthony books when I was probably around 12 or 13.
Yeah.
And I thought they were a blast. And then
they're amazing. Yeah.
I didn't really connect with the idea that, oh, Piers Anthony's books are kind of creepy, until I think it was college, the first time I actually talked to someone about Piers Anthony's books, and they pointed it out. And it's that weird thing where your brain suddenly goes, oh my Lord, they're right. Like,
yeah. Once you make that switch.
Yeah.
I was kind of like, oh my gosh. I think the first time I actually had that thought was one of the books, the centaur girl with wings, was talking about how like she worked out all her muscles a lot. So she was very built, and she was like, you know, getting physically developed. And then just the way they phrased it, I was like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. I think I was like 13, 14 when that kind of clicked in my head too. But
right. Did your parents, were they fine with you reading like a lot of science fiction and fantasy and that kind of stuff?
My father was an English professor, so absolutely not. Absolutely not. He was like, oh, I bought a Dragonlance book, and he's like tearing apart the first page because he just didn't like me reading like fantasy. You know, fantasy tends to not be as literary as just about everything else.
Well, it tends to be way more about plot than it is about language.
Right. But he was just like going through, he's like, this is blah, blah, blah. And it just, you know what? He was happy with me learning English, reading whatever I wanted to read. But when it got to a certain time, he wanted to read like Beowulf or some shit like that.
Right.
And I'm like, what are you talking about? You know?
Yeah.
So, but it was good. I mean, it was good. He didn't want me to read. He just wanted me to read more classics. He taught Shakespeare in college, you know? And then when I was 16, I'm like, Dad, I'm going to be an English professor. I'm going to be an English major just like you. I'm going to write books for a living. And that's when he said, you know, no, son, don't be an English major. Your life will suffer. So.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
At what point did you seriously start writing?
You know what? I mean, so when my dad did tell me that I should be an English major because, you know, my life will suffer, I went into computer science, you know, graduated that. I worked consulting for a few years. It wasn't until I was probably later in my 20s, you know, 25, 27 maybe, where, you know, I was just thinking about it. I was like, I don't like my career.
Yeah.
You know, all I do now is work and, like, you know, do kung fu. And there's, I don't want to be still doing this 10 years from now. So I started to, you know, I just thought back to, like, what did I want to be when I was a kid? What really inspired me to, like, do something cool? And it was writing. So I just started writing, you know, here and there. And once I kind of rediscovered the fact that I really like storytelling, I also realized that if I really want to do this, I can't do 10 things and do any of them well. So if I really want to do this, I have to do it well.
Yeah.
And the only way to do it well is to really, you know, put all my eggs into that work, you know, put everything into that thing. So I quit kung fu, I quit going clubbing, I quit a whole bunch of stuff. And then for like 2-3 years, I just worked on, you know, I wrote a low fantasy, and then I wrote the first draft of The Lives of Tao.
Yeah.
Then I think that was in like 2007 when I finished, like, whole bunch of rewrites for that. And then I got sidetracked by World of Warcraft, as you do. You know,
Didn't we all,
you know, I was a raid officer.
Oh man. So you actually had like guild responsibilities.
Oh, we were the number one guild on Anubarak. And
I mean, I've talked to friends who have done like serious like raiding in World of Warcraft, and it's a part-time job.
Oh yeah. We had 150 raiders in our guild.
Whew.
And I was the recruitment officer in the number one guild on the server, which meant anybody who wanted any kind of like good loot had to go through me.
Yeah.
It was a total power trip. On top of that, I mean, and I'll say this to this day, managing a whole bunch of people, ranging 16 to 40, 50,
yeah,
to like organize them together to be a cohesive unit is like one of the best project management training I ever had. You know,
yeah,
because you can't just yell at these people to do whatever you want. You just got relationships. Some of them are dating. Some of them broken up. You know, it's
right.
It is so much, but it really taught me, like, okay, this is how you kind of become a good organizer of people. So
yeah,
it was a good experience.
So then you wrote Lives of Tao, and you sold it around 2011.
Around like 2008, end of 2010, 2011. I just kind of, you know, I got burned out from raiding.
Yeah,
again, I had to do a little soul searching again. You know, what do I want to do with my life? And, you know, that's when I realized that, hey, let's go back to writing. I had a really good early draft. I did a rewrite of that draft in 2011, 2012, I think. I remember 2010, 2011. And then Angry Robot, which is my publisher, and they had an open submission from like in March, where like from March 1st to March 31st, anybody can submit to us.
Yeah.
And then we'll see what happens. And they had 995 submissions over that time period. And out of those, you know, 1,000 submissions or so, 5 people got book deals. And I was one of those 5.
Ooh.
It's like the publishing by Thunderdome, I guess.
Right.
And that's where we go from there.
And that launched your career.
Yeah.
Now you've done really well with getting a TV and film options.
I've done okay.
Do you think that is an aspect of the genre you write in, or personal connections, or just having a really good agent?
I mean, I don't think it's a genre thing. I think, you know, I mean, options happen all the time, depending on different stories, you know?
Yeah.
I do think that my writing style, my storytelling style, lends very well to the screen.
Yeah.
So definitely you need a great agent, great manager. You know, you need to have great storytelling. But when it comes, I mean, I think particularly my style just lends very well. It's, you know, to having something on screen. And then once you learn about how like TV and film works, I write with TV and film optioning in mind,
yeah.
But because it works well with my style, I do kind of like want to make sure that everything I work on has that ability to transition over.
Yeah. Now, but you have some kind of some experience in TV and film, because you worked as a stuntman.
I did some stunt work, and I was an actor. So I was a screen and I was a SAG member. And
when was that?
Oh, this is during the 2000s, you know.
Yeah.
Most of it was commercial work. I did, you know, a lot of like, you know, selling like insurance, or, you know,
right.
Or like, you know, doing a post office ad, or I was once in an underwear commercial. So, which made me the world's ugliest underwear model. That's what I like to say. But I mean, they don't really correlate, to be honest. I think moving forward, because of the way streaming works now, how there's so many more platforms, and just the way how publishing is so hard for writers to make money these days.
Yeah.
That you almost have to have that channel of like TV options, TV film options, as a source of revenue, because it's becoming an increasingly bigger part of all our revenue.
Yeah.
You have one too, right? You have an option going for Promise of Blood?
Yeah, I've got an option for Powder Mage, and that was pretty recent. Mm-hmm. I think that was announced last fall.
Right.
But you had Michael Bay option. Was it the Tau series, or was it Time Salvager that he optioned?
Michael Bay optioned the option was with Michael Bay attached for Time Salvager. That actually left.
Oh, okay.
So now that's with another production company. So I'm actually don't think that's not public yet, but it's with somebody else right now.
Right. Okay. And I think you've already got an option for the martial arts epic, right?
War Art Saga got optioned before I finished the book.
That is insane to me. Like, that's the reason I brought the whole thing up. I mean, Michael Bay being attached to something is really cool, but optioning something before the book's even finished is really amazing.
Dude, I really enjoyed it. Well, you know what?
Yeah, I bet you're very pleased with that.
It was, you know, it just kind of worked out. I mean, to be fair, when I started submitting War Art Saga, I wrote, originally I was like, I'm gonna write a partial and see what happens. Okay, I'm gonna write the prologue of this series.
Yeah.
And you know, if it goes somewhere, it goes somewhere. We'll see if it sells. And the prologue though became a 60,000 words.
Whew.
So it was really a first act for the first book.
Yeah.
So yes, it was a partial, but it was a very substantial partial.
Yeah.
And it was a partial that had a beginning, introduction. You know, it had an ending in its own way. It was the first act. So because it was almost a complete, it could have been a book one if I really wanted to, like, you know, make it longer. So that's where that went. And because it was a complete story, it was easier to sell to the industry.
Right. Now, you don't have to answer this question if you don't want, but have you made more money off of selling books or selling options? The very fact that you have to think about it is what kind of intrigues me, because, you know, I have one option, and it is, you know, it's a good option, but it's a less than a single digit percentage point of my income.
Right. Well, I've sold five options and I only own three IPs. So two of them I've sold twice.
Yeah.
No, I've made more money off selling books. But, you know, I mean, the optioning is such a strange process. I mean, I feel like Hollywood is a very strange process. It's a very strange industry. I mean, it's,
yeah.
You know, when they option something, they're not actually buying. They're just reserving the right to buy it at a later day. That's what an option is.
Yeah.
You know, there's an option price and a purchase price. And if you think about it, there's over 600 projects in development right now in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And what, something like 96% of them will go nowhere.
Right.
So there are people just optioning, they're just throwing money and optioning things. And then they're hiring, you know, screenwriters, and they're hiring production guys, and they're doing all this work, and chances are nothing will come out of it.
Yeah.
I just, it boggles my mind how, like, in a way, how inefficient it is. But then that's also how, you know, creative works happen, is, you know, it's an inefficient process.
Right. It's creative people with money is what Hollywood is.
Right.
You know, I think it's Robert Jackson Bennett who says that getting a TV option is like being paid to hold a lottery ticket.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's I used to think that, but I remember like early on in my career when like I learned how options work, and I'm like, you're going to pay me this much money to do this?
Yeah.
All right. And if 99% of the time, nothing's going to happen from it, then we might as well go for the cash grab. Just pay me. Pay me the money. And I'm gonna people say, hey, when you get an option, take the money, push it out of your head, because chances are nothing's going to happen, and keep working. It's just free money.
Yeah.
And more recently, the past couple of years, I've actually changed that mindset. I'm like, well, if you're gonna option something, I want whoever options it to get the best possible chance of success.
Yeah.
So when we're selling War Arts, you know, we had 4 or 5 offers, I think, and I did go with the most money.
Yeah.
I went with the person who I thought, okay, who can drag this to the finish line? Who can actually get it made? Who has the best talent that lined up? You know, I mean, when we took the offers in, one of the biggest deciding factors was, you know, the guy, the producer.
Yeah.
What is his track record? My producer made The Boys.
Yeah.
It's just one of my favorite IPs right now. You know, he's done a lot of like amazing shows that I love to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a great track record of bringing shows, you know, onto the screen. And then the showrunner that we brought on board, this guy Jason Ning, was, you know, one of the writers for head writers for Lucifer, who's also one of my favorite shows.
Right.
So it's suddenly you're looking at the bigger picture of not just the cash grab. You're looking, or not the money. You're looking at, you know, who, what kind of team are they going to build around this IP to give the best possible chance of getting made?
Yeah.
So that took an evolution for me.
That's cool. Now you've done both your own novels, but also worked on tie-in novels.
I have
with Cassandra Clare and with The Walking Dead.
Yes.
Now, do you when you look at those projects, do you think you personally, after having done so many of both, do you think you enjoy one process over the other, or do you think that they're just totally different things that are just different aspects of your job?
I think the storytelling aspect of it's the same.
Yeah.
You know, writing an engaging story with characters and having interesting things happen to them is very similar across the board. And I mean, I didn't feel like it was that different from writing like a horror book. Like, horror with The Walking Dead versus what I was doing, the science fiction I was doing before versus doing fantasy now. I feel like they're more related than not.
Yeah.
There's something to be said though about working in somebody else's sandbox. You know, you're following. You are no longer God.
Right.
And that takes a little bit getting used to. Is, you know, not only are you have to follow by somebody else's rules on world building, but you also have to follow it's their characters. You can only do so much with their characters, and their characters have their personalities that you really have to follow.
Yeah.
It's different, but I found it pretty enjoyable. I mean, part of it depends on your partners.
Yeah.
I've been very fortunate. Like, Cassie was great to work with, and I really learned about her writing process in terms of like how she crafts her characters, how she builds her world, and how she kind of like how she establishes relationships.
Yeah.
Like her relationships, like her fans are just amazing because they love the character so much.
Right.
And I kind of was able to kind of break down like how has she created this universe where she has such devoted fans, you know, and it's really incredible. Actually, she's kind of a genius that way.
Yeah.
And for Walking Dead, you know, Walking Dead is The Walking Dead. You know, it's one of the biggest properties out there. So when I was working on it, I was working with, you know, Robert Kirkman and like, you know, Mike Braff at Skybound at the time. And it was one interesting thing is once we got the environment, the setting and the rules of the universe down, you know, he gave me a pretty free rein. You know, just tell the story you want to tell based off of this information that we've given you.
Yeah.
And I wrote this huge outline and they gave me edits and they gave me like basically say, once we were on the same page, you're like, just go and do your thing. You know, tell us a story that you want to tell, but in our world. And that was a very freeing aspect. Usually from what I understand, a lot of tie-ins will try to grab control with their property.
Mm-hmm.
So the author has very limited, very limited bandwidth on where they can steer.
Right. But
in this case, in both cases, actually, I was given a pretty pretty free reign to do it right whatever I want, you know, within the scope of what they have.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, I've always been intrigued by the idea of kind of these tie-in intellectual property work, because writing novels tends to be, I mean, with some exceptions, it tends to be very solitary. But I'm fascinated by collaborative writing, because most other writers have a lot more chances to do collaborative writing. You know, comedians and screenwriters and TV writers and
right.
all these different types of writers will often work with other people to create something. And we don't usually. And it's a little bit lonely, but you have that kind of trade-off between being in charge and being a little bit lonely versus being just one of the cogs and working with other people.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it depends on the IP. Like, if you're going to work on Star Wars, you're going to be on a short leash.
Yeah.
You know, and then part of it's because, you know, the Star Wars is such a known commodity. It's the characters are so well known, and you know, there's this Star Wars Bible that you really need to tear by. So that could be amazing, because who doesn't want to write a Star Wars book? But it's also like, you have to really, really be a cog. You have to be willing to be a cog and kind of just, you know, push the story the way somebody else really is driving.
Yeah.
You know? I was a little lucky because I was able to drive a lot of it myself. If I was being driven quite a bit on some of these projects, I might have chafed a little bit, but that was not the case.
That's great. I'm glad. That's fun. Are you looking forward to getting back to your own kind of universes now?
Yes. I mean, I spent 3 years working on, you know, two Shadowhunter books and the Walking Dead book. And
yeah.
Before I started doing my own stuff again, I mean, the last time I published my own stuff was 2016. So it's been a while.
Yeah.
And so it's time. And especially in this day and age, you know, with, again, like I always talk about how, like, I try to take, you know, all our revenue streams in mind, is right now IP is king, you know? So because of the way platforms are, you know, there's so many more platforms now, everybody's so starved for content that publishing your own stuff is really the best way moving forward, you know.
Yeah,
it's how you make the most money. Suddenly, when you control your own IP, you can sell rights, you know, the foreign rights, the audio rights, the option rights. There's so many more buckets to work with, but you know, but it's also a lot more risky.
Right. It's almost like it's working for a tie-in is almost like having a normal job, because you're just kind of going to work and doing a creative thing,
right?
But you're doing it for someone else. Versus working on your own intellectual property, you're taking both the benefits and the risks of, you know, it might bomb or it might get a TV show that
it might blow up, right?
Yeah.
But when you do tie in, or you know, and you usually get paid up front too. That's always nice. Getting paid up front is usually nice.
So, how many books are in the new series that you're under contract for?
Three. I'm under contract for three. I have a completed plot for a completed arc for all three books. The first book's 180,000 words. Book two and three will probably be around 200 a piece, maybe more. A part of me really wants to go to five books. like in my head, I'm like, I could totally, you know, take this kind of like issue on this side, really blow it up and really have a grand story that goes to five books. But then, I don't know, man. I mean, series fatigue is a real thing, you know, and I just don't know if I have it in me to like really stay in this world, especially in epic fantasy world, for five full books.
Man, I think about that kind of stuff a lot. I had originally kind of had been planning for the second of the Powder Mage series to be five books. And then my editor left right after editing the first book. She ended up getting, you know, poached by Tor. And so she left, and I kind of was, you know, orphaned at my publisher, and thought, man, I can't kind of be an orphaned author and try to add two more books to this,
right,
this plot line. And so all these kind of little things I had been setting up and plot lines I had been kind of hoping to expand upon, I ended up having to trim kind of a lot, and it was a little bit of a frustrating experience, because going into that. But I think about the idea of doing a five book epic fantasy series, because I feel like that would, I don't know, it feels like it would fit with my style a little bit more. But again, maybe it would end up being a disaster. So who knows?
Well, what about your new series? I mean, what do you see with your new series?
Well, it's a three book contract.
Okay.
And honestly, the first book has to come out before, if I want to do five books for that, which I would definitely not, you know, totally look over the idea. But if I wanted to do five books, the first book would need to come out
and do really well
and do really well. You know, if the first book comes out and it hits single digits on the Times list or something like that, and they come back to me and say, "Hey, do you think you maybe want to add to this contract?" I'd probably say yes, but honestly,
let's play ball then. Yeah.
Yeah. But it, you know, you don't want to get tied for long series to a single publisher who, you know, your editor might change or the publisher might merge with somebody else, or, you know, there's a lot of small risks you don't really think about in terms of long-term contracts.
Right. Well, here's also the problem is, like, by the time you know that book one is doing well or not,
yeah,
book, you've already handed book two in.
That's the big problem.
Probably. You've probably already handed book two in. So,
yeah.
Like for me, I was going through this problem where, like, I have an arc for five books if I really want to follow it. Mm. But right now, I'm working under the assumption that it's just a three-book deal.
Yeah.
And if book one does just, you know, shoot out of the gate and they want five books, I'm going to need to do, it's going to have to be a massive rewrite of book two. And frankly, I don't want to write a book again.
Right. That's hard. You never, trying to plan these things in, one of the things that they don't really talk to you about in creative writing classes a lot, with some exceptions, is balancing your creative life with the business realities of running a small business and planning ahead in terms of how business will affect the creative intellectual property you're working on.
Right.
You know?
I mean, do they have any classes for that?
Yeah.
I've never heard of any, at least, you know,
you get those.
There, I have never heard of any class, maybe a workshop about, like, the business of writing. And on one hand, I feel like there should be a business of writing class. But on the other hand, is that going to actually be, is there that many people who want to go into the business of writing?
Oh yeah, there's tons. I mean, Brandon Sanderson, you know, his classes that I took a long time ago that he still teaches, he always was really good about covering the business things.
Oh, okay.
Now you wouldn't, I don't think he talked a lot about kind of what we're talking about in terms of long-term planning and stuff like that, because it's, you really can't talk about that until you're in the field. But he was really good about showing people contracts and talking about how you know, how agents work and, you know, all the basic stuff that nowadays you can find most of that information online pretty easily.
Right.
But when I was taking the class, there wasn't a lot of that.
Okay.
And I think that his very public sort of, I like to talk about how writing is done,
right,
with both, you know, his podcast Writing Excuses and his classes and his public lectures and stuff like that, they do really well for that sort of thing. I think it promoted it a lot.
Right. I mean,
yeah,
Brandon's always been very, very good about that stuff. You know, really, like, he's been very, you know, free with his knowledge, and obviously he's one of the most successful writers out there. No, Brandon and I went to seventh grade together in Nebraska.
I know, I was gonna bring that up earlier, and I find that very funny.
We're the same age, we went to the same, you know, it was a junior high / high school combined in seventh grade. We were in the same, same classes probably. And look, our careers are almost similar.
No,
not quite.
Does your dad ever ask you why you don't have sales like Brandon?
You know, I'm very thankful he doesn't know who Brandon is. You know, honestly, my dad gave me, if he didn't give me grief, he was just worried about me, you know, because he knows how difficult it is to, like, make a living doing what we do.
Yeah.
So up until 2016, he's always like, you know,
yeah,
you sure you don't want to back up? You sure you don't want to, you know, you sure don't, I could get you an interview at this bank or whatever here and there, whatever. We can, you know, you have a kid coming. You got a,
right,
a stable job is what you know. It's very, a little old fashioned, you know, but it's also like, I'm like, Dad, man, the only thing I want to fall back on is, like, my ass. You know, if this doesn't work out, then I will have given everything I had and try to make a career out of this. If it doesn't work out, then I will figure something out. But until then, until I've fallen on my ass, then I'm gonna give it a go. And so far, you know, it's been good.
Yeah.
I do have concerns that, look, it still boggles my mind how, like, certain authors can sustain 30-year careers, you know, but if you look at it, you and I, we debuted the exact same time. We're pushing 10 years.
It's not too far.
Not too far in the future. I mean, we are very in the thick of things.
Yeah. We've both been really fortunate with that. And, you know, it's that combination of luck and skill.
It's luck and skill.
You know, and you need different, you know, you need a little bit of each. Little column A, little column B.
You need a little bit of each and you need a lot of grit.
Yeah.
You
know? Hard work. Hard work's the other column.
Publishing will punch you in the face many, many times. And, you know, and most of the times you just have to like take the hits, you know, go mope for a weekend or so, and then just kind of pick yourself back up and just be like, it has to be done, you know?
Oh yeah.
And there's something to be said about how when you convert your hobby into your career, you really have to adjust your mindset for how you approach it. And, you know, and previously, you know, we operated a lot off inspiration.
Yeah.
I want to be a writer. I want to tell the story. I want to do these things because it's fun.
That's so true.
And I like doing it with in my spare time.
Right.
You know, now we are contractually obligated to be creative, you know, and when it's not coming, we got to work, you know. When it's coming, great. But when it's not coming, we still got to figure it out anyway. And chances are,
right,
these words might suck and we might delete all these words, but we got to keep plugging at it because it's now literally our job. It's how we feed ourselves.
Hey, man, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate you.
Cool. I love hanging out with you, buddy.
That was author Wesley Chu. Thanks again to Wes for his time. You can find links to Wes's social media and some of his books down in the show notes. You can find me, as usual, at brianmcclellan.com. Special thanks to James Sutter for music and Tom Bishop for production support. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak or buy my books in ebook, paperback, or audio. Don't forget to like and subscribe.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.